Hey, folks, you're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire radio podcast. A couple of things I want to tell you. One, we can't do this free version without our members. And you can become one of those people. Head over to ROFpodcast.com right now. Become a member. You'll get the full radio show without commercials. And we'll give you total access to our archives over the past 10 years. It's a great deal. And it keeps this show chugging along. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Enjoy the show. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, Eric Levitz from New York Magazine's Intelligencer will be here to explain the Bernie versus Warren debate we need. The executive editor of the American Prospect, David Dane, will tell us why we're living in an era of zero accountability when it comes to Trump's impeachment. Heather Digby Parton will be here to help me run down an important week in the news and our progressive candidate spotlight this week. We'll be with Albert Lee. He's running against incumbent Earl Blumenauer in Portland's 3rd District. If you're listening to the radio right now, you should know that there's a free one-hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever your podcasts are found. There's also a member show. You can support Ring of Fire by becoming a member, getting our three-hour radio show without commercials, and access to over 10 years of our archives. You can go to ROFpodcast.com to sign up. Help me run down a busy week in the news. Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, sort of a crazy week this week. We are, I don't know how to really describe this. I have a feeling, and I apologize both to our physical and mental well-being, but I have a feeling it's going to be like this for the next 13 months to some extent or another. This week we are in the wake of the beginnings of the impeachment inquiry. We still don't know what impeachment is going to look like in many respects. There was an attempt at first to say that this is going to be a limited impeachment inquiry, but it seems like that is going to be more and more difficult for those in the Democratic Party that want this all to go away for some reason, which I don't understand why, frankly, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, but we should just start with, I don't know, headlining some of the major developments over the past week that have taken place, including the subpoenaing of documents from Mike Pompeo, who has thus far refused to deliver, the subpoenaing of documents from Rudy Giuliani, who has thus far failed to deliver. We should say that because of this impeachment inquiry, the Judiciary Committee has basically said your refusal to turn these documents or your failure to turn these documents over will be seen as de facto obstruction. It will be not just evidence of but it will be the basis of a charge of obstruction in the impeachment inquiry. We also have the story of Bill Barr and Donald Trump going around and pressuring world leaders, and this seems to be sort of consistent with what we saw with Ukraine, to basically undercut the Mueller report that Russia was involved in interfering with our election. We also have Mike Pompeo revealing that he was, in fact, on the Ukraine call where Donald Trump was leaning on the Ukrainians to deliver dirt on Joe Biden, and it appears to come up with some type of narrative that suggests that Russia didn't some of this is confusing. And I think part of that's by design, don't you?
I do think so. I mean, I don't know how much Trump is involved in throwing out this stuff as a distraction. It seems to me that he himself is distracted. And I don't think he really has the mental capacity to do anything this complicated. But certainly the right-wing operatives who've been pushing all these, you know, alternating conspiracy theories over the past couple of years are totally able to do it, as are some foreign actors, Russia among them, to put out, you know, a mass amount of sort of disinformation, confusing conspiracy theories to just kind of muddy the water and make it difficult to sort out what really happened. And I think that is part of the plan here. But specifically, what Trump, and you said this quite well and very clearly, what he is trying to do and what is vastly important to him is to prove that the Russia is to somehow, you know, delegitimize the Mueller report. Now, we know for a fact, and this came out just this week, that you remember that conversation that he had in the Oval Office shortly after he was inaugurated with Kislyak and the foreign minister of Russia. And they were, you know, they didn't announce it to anybody, and we only found out about it because the Russian news agency put out pictures of it, and later found out that he had said in that meeting that, you know, hey, I just got rid of James Comey. He was on this Russia thing, and, you know, that's gone now. And he gave them some very highly, highly classified information that, you know, that they had been provided apparently by the Israeli government. And this was a big scandal at the time. We just found out there was something else that he said in that meeting, which had never come out until now, which was that he said, hey, you know, this interference in the election, it's no big deal. We do it, too, which indicates that he knew and that all of this, you know, Sturm und Drang that we're seeing now about trying to discredit Mueller and all that is not being done because he is, you know, he's upset that anyone would think that his election wasn't legitimate. We know now that he knows that. And basically this is all about, you know, throwing up this smokescreen for his, I don't know, his place in history, or to just prove that somehow to the American people that he wasn't illegitimately elected, but he knows that he was. So we can set aside any ideas that this is just some psychological problem with Trump, and he's just, you know, golly, poor guy, he's just kind of dumb and doesn't really know what he's doing. He knows what he's doing. This is a conscious effort on his part to do that. And what he's doing is enlisting his government now, yep, the United States government, to go out there and find manufactured evidence, because he knows it's not true, right? He admitted that to the Russians, find manufactured evidence to coerce foreign governments. We saw what he did with Ukraine, and now we've learned this week that they've been talking to governments all over the world, Australia, the UK, Italy, to get them to somehow back up this theory that they have worked up, that Russia didn't actually interfere in the election, and that the CIA knew about it, and that they worked, you know, hand in glove apparently with Mueller, because Mueller would have had to know this, right? I mean, they right, investigated all this. That this was a fake news story, a hoax, as Trump has put it from the beginning, in order to delegitimize Donald Trump. I mean, they are now using the power of the government, with the help, by the way, that firsthand help of the Attorney General of the United States. So, I mean, this is crazy time, and I know that sounds confusing, and it is, partially because this is such a Baroque scandal that is very, very hard. You know, it makes you yearn for the days of Monica Lewinsky when we kind of knew what was going on. This right, is crazy time. But that's part of the reasoning, certainly among the right wing, on how to sort of get Donald Trump out of this. I mean, and I have to ask myself, Sam, why are these people so invested in this man? What in the world are these Republicans doing? I mean, anybody else, I really think in history, we would have seen them throwing in the towel on the guy. The guy is absolutely out of control. He's behaving irrationally. This whole story is ridiculous. And they're backing him. And they've got, you know, Bill Barr out there doing this. You've got a special prosecutor, with him. And it's nuts. And it kind of, I mean, I'm feeling a little bit more disturbed than usual over that, because this is really crazy stuff, and the Republicans so far are standing firm. And, you know, wow.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, let's take a break, and go through. I mean, I don't think we can go through this too much, frankly, in terms of trying to bring some clarity, because it is incredibly convoluted. And again, I think that's part of the plan. But there yeah. is definitely a narrative out there, and I think that the right is trying to form. And it frankly, it is another reason why impeachment was so necessary. We get to take a quick break. We'll talk about that on the other side. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio, talking to the great Digby. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he has been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder here with Digby. So, Heather, in the last segment, we went over stuff that we could theoretically go over again because it's so dense and difficult to follow in many respects. But it appears to me that in the absence of impeachment, in fact, I think this would happen regardless, right? Putting aside impeachment as an inquiry and the revelations that are leading to impeachment. It is quite clear that there has been an ongoing project in the White House, like you say, that has, Bill Barr is an active participant in this. I would also suggest that Mike Pompeo is an active participant in this.
Yes.
That the State Department is an active participant in it. Right now, the State Department, apparently, and the State Department IG, we're not 100% clear on why the Inspector General of the State Department rushed to Congress earlier this week to tell them about something that's going on. But I've heard dubious things about this IG. But what we do know is that the State Department retroactively classified what could be hundreds, if not thousands, of emails that were written at no later than when Hillary Clinton left office as in the State Department, which was 2013. So we're talking about emails that were written between like 2008 and 2013 by State Department officials. 130 of them are under investigation for sending emails to Clinton that have been retroactively classified. At the time, they were not classified. Now the State Department says they were classified. Like they're now adding this categorization to these emails, and they're now investigating these people for breaking classification rules. It seems to me like that exercise and the simultaneous exercise, put aside what I think Trump was looking for in terms of Joe Biden and Hunter Biden for the 2020 election. They are also creating this narrative, like you outlined for us before, that it was not the Russians who interfered in the election, but rather some type of cabal between the CIA, the Obama administration, and the Ukrainians. And Bill Barr has been going around the world with the special prosecutor he appointed to investigate this, trying to find governments that will build on this narrative. And this is why when you and I would talk about impeachment, why we would say it was so crucial, because there's a vacuum. And if the Democrats don't fill it, the Republicans were already planning to. They, you know, this is on some level what we've stumbled upon with the, that has led to impeachment, at least the impeachment inquiry, was the attempt of them to build this narrative, both in the future, a future narrative and a narrative about the past, which is that I mean, it on some level, like, you got Bill Barr going around trying to prove that Q is right. The QAnon. I mean, honestly, that's what's going on here. Yeah. This is bizarre stuff. And
it's beyond bizarre, Sam.
And that's why Seb Gorka was traveling with Mike Pompeo to Italy. Seb Gorka's not part of the government. He's just some right-wing talker now. And that's why they bringing him. I'm convinced of it. I think that's part of his, like, he's there. This is basically like, let's go to, Italy and do some spitballing and try and come up with a good narrative for, you know, to piece this thing together. It's crazy. It's like, this is like WorldNet Daily, except for they have all the resources of the U.S. government.
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, I mean, we could go deep into the weeds here, but I would suggest that you actually speak with Marcy Wheeler if you want to get deep into it, because her understanding of this is really amazing that she has all these threads of this conspiracy theory. But you mentioned that Barr was in Italy, and it was basically to listen to a tape recording by this guy, Joseph Mifsud, who was a sort of a minor player in the Mueller investigation and had been involved with George Papadopoulos. I'm not even going to get into that. I recommend everybody go read Empty Wheel online, emptywheel.net, if you want to get deep into what the details of this conspiracy theory. But let me just put it this way. It's exactly what you said, Sam. This is the Attorney General of the United States and a U.S. attorney. They didn't even send some FBI agent, which is what you would normally do to do this. He went over there personally on the basis of what has been a buildup over the course of a couple of years by people like The Hill's John Solomon, people like Chuck Johnson. I mean, these are fringe people. They really are. I mean, Solomon used to be a mainstream reporter, but he's been relegated to the fringe for many years now as a right-wing operative. And, you know, they've been building up this, you know, Sean Hannity and you know, people like Victoria Tenzing and Joe DeGeneva, who were also revealed this week to be working with Rudy Giuliani on this whole crazy, crazy story. I mean, this is out there on the fringe of the right wing that has been pushing this thing. And it's exactly as you said. We're watching is this development of, you know, a filling of the vacuum. And I still regret, honestly, that the Democrats didn't pull the trigger earlier, because I think if they had, this was just sort of getting up to speed.
Yes.
I'm grateful that they've finally done it. But, you know, I think that they would have been ahead of the game on this counter narrative, which you and I talked about at length for months. We were saying, hey, look, you know, if you don't do this, they will.
They will, indeed. Indeed. Well, listen, we got to take a break here, but let's talk about this and more on the other side. There's another whistleblower out there. The real question is, what are the Democrats going to be doing going forward here? And how much teeth are their subpoenas actually going to have? I think more than people think. We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Digby will be joining me in the next hour. Just ahead. Are we living in an era of no accountability? I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Hey, folks, Sam Cedar here. If you like Ring of Fire Radio, and if you like the Majority Report, have I got news for you. Every morning, we do a five-minute podcast. It's less than 5 minutes, in fact, and it gives you all the top headlines you're going to need to know throughout the day. It's called the AM Quickie. We deliver all this news, and we do it really quick. And we do it in the morning. That's how we came up with the title, AM Quickie. You can sign up at amquickie.com or wherever your podcasts are found. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he has been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours pouring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Impeachment inquiries have begun against President Donald Trump in what might be a turning point in an era where accountability has since been forgotten. Here to explain the importance of impeachment and lay out his day one agenda, if and when we elect a Democratic president in 2020, David Dayen from the American Prospect. So, David, there's a couple of things I want to talk to you about. Pieces, obviously, from the American Prospect. You guys have launched, I'm not even sure how to describe it, but it's fascinating, and it's an incredibly important tool for progressives and to impact, hopefully, what will be a brighter future. That is the day one agenda. We'll talk about that in the second half of this interview, because before we get to the idea of what a Democratic president could do on day one, we need to talk about this president and what his chances for reelection are, and how what has happened in the past, it feels like months of stuff, but really it's been about, 2 weeks, 10 days of the complete, I don't want to say a complete 180 in terms of the Democratic caucus, but certainly in terms of the Democratic leadership on the question of impeachment and what it implies. You wrote a piece about Trump's impeachment in the era of no accountability. I don't know if you would argue that that era is over, but why don't you tell us what that era has been?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're a week and a half in. We'll see if that era is over. But, you know, I mean, you can draw a through line between the lack of prosecutions for the financial crisis, the Catholic Church scandal, everything that was in Chris Hayes' book, Twilight of the Elites. And you see this persistent inability to hold accountable people who are on sort of a higher level politically, socially, in terms of their financial power, than everybody else. There's a two-tiered system of justice in America, and that's true of the corporate boardroom. It's true of political figures. People get away with things, whether you're talking about Jeffrey Epstein or whether you're talking about Jamie Dimon. So we have seen this create social unrest, dissension on the left and the right, whether you're talking about Occupy Wall Street or the Tea Party. It has created, I think, an undercurrent of anger in the population over a rigged system. And this accumulation, I think, forced the hand of the Democratic leadership. Maybe 20 years ago, if you had someone like Trump doing the things that he was doing, you could see Nancy Pelosi taking impeachment off the table, as she did in 2006 with George W. Bush over torture and over lying us into war in Iraq. But the accumulation of these abuses that don't that nobody takes responsibility for, that there's no punishment for, I think led to the Democrats and Nancy Pelosi in particular being forced into a position where they had to act.
You know, it's interesting because when you think about the younger generation of this freshman class of congresspeople, and I'm specifically thinking about the Squad, but, you know, and you had Rashida Tlaib early on saying, you know, we're going to impeach this mofo, as it were. And sort of the passion. And it's fascinating because, you know, you and I are vets to a certain extent in, you know, at least in this century, in terms of how Democrats behave, how conservatives respond. And the, when we were doing this type of stuff back in the mid-aughts, you'd hear a lot about, you know, you Democrats are so angry. And the irony was, is that they weren't angry enough. And now that we have who Democrats coming in, who by all accounts are angered, they're angered at this, you know, what you've just described, this era of a lack of accountability, the idea that Steve Mnuchin should have been in jail instead of the Treasury Secretary, right? Just, you know, as an example, but the list goes on and on and on. And it's interesting. You don't hear that anymore. I mean, on some level, what we're seeing is Nancy Pelosi, this bubbling up from newly elected Democrats leading the charge on impeachment, and also presidential candidates who are out on the trail and are absorbing this level of discontent.
Yeah, I think that's a factor. And also, I think there's a big factor that needs to be considered in the form of AOC. So AOC won a primary against the guy who was going to become number three in the House leadership. And what Pelosi was hearing from members, both incumbents who had been there for many years and also freshman incumbents, was that they were getting pressure to their left and primary challenges, specifically on the inaction of the Democratic caucus around Trump's corruption. There are something like 111 primary races among Democrats of incumbent members, which is a very, very large number. We've seen the concept sort of proven through the AOC race, and it was not tenable for Democrats to sleepwalk through the next 2 years and just try to get to the next election without taking any sort of action. It was not going to be tenable for incumbents who were in primary races where this was becoming a signature issue. And so I think that, as much as anything, kind of prodded Pelosi to act. And what are we seeing now in the aftermath of this? We're a couple weeks out. The polls have completely shifted. It kind of reminds me of Mitch McConnell. There's this quote when he's talking about the beginning of the Obama era and why he didn't want anything to be bipartisan. And he said something like, you know, I wanted the public to know there was a great debate happening in Washington. So we couldn't make anything bipartisan. We had to draw the distinction. And that's what this did. People don't necessarily tune in to everything going on the way that political junkies do. But when they see an impeachment inquiry, they think, oh, well, something must have happened that was pretty bad, because Democrats are now talking about removing the president. And that's sometimes all it takes to pierce, you know, the normal level of inertia within the population, within the voting public. So I really think that this ended up being very good politics in addition to being the right thing to do.
Right. And lastly, let's just say this, too, that I think, you know, the Democrats usually are very ineffective at nationalizing elections. Now, of course, when you have an on-year election with the president, that becomes a surrogate for a lot of races. But now it's going to be very tangible, too, right? Because I think we are inevitably going to see the impeachment of Donald Trump. It's unclear to me what happens in the Senate. Mitch McConnell's claiming that he's going to hold a vote there. I wonder if that isn't just to scare Chuck Schumer, but we can talk about that down the road, maybe. But the fact of the matter is, particularly if they have a vote in the Senate, and, you know, I noticed a Mark Levin tweet this week talking about impeachment being strictly a Democratic thing. That puts a lot of pressure on someone like Susan Collins and a couple other Republican senators. This is going to be a way for Democratic candidates across the country to nationalize their election with one question: how did you vote on impeachment? And that's going to make for a very, very distinct difference. And it's going to make it totally every race. You know, congressperson or Senate, in a referendum on Donald Trump. And I wouldn't want to be the candidate having to go to bat for Donald Trump after this.
Yeah, I mean, we're even looking at the prospect at the state legislative races in Virginia this that are coming up in November, and seeing how the Trump impeachment is playing into those. And I bet you it does. This transcends normal party politics. Yeah,
I agree. Well, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, let's talk about the day one agenda that you guys have been working at the American Prospect, because this gives us a sense of exactly what a Democratic president could do on day one, regardless of who controls the Senate. We're going to take a quick break. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back with David Dayen after this. Hey folks, Sam Cedar here. If you like Ring of Fire Radio, and if you like the Majority Report, have I got news for you. Every morning, we do a 5-minute podcast. It's less than 5 minutes, in fact, and it gives you all the top headlines you're going to need to know throughout the day. It's called the AM Quickie. We deliver all this news, and we do it really quick, and we do it in the morning. That's how we came up with the title, AM Quickie. You can sign up at amquickie.com or wherever your podcasts are found.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America.
Fraud.
Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Back on Ring of Fire Radio, I'm Sam Cedar. Right now, I'm talking to David Dayen about impeachment and the day one agenda in hopes that a Democrat wins the White House in 2020. So, David, in the last segment, we were talking about impeachment, both in terms of, I guess, the ethical, moral, I guess, or the civic duty to impeach and to have at least an attempt to revive the concept of accountability for the powerful and wealthy in this country. The other part of that was the political implications of it. It could very well be that impeachment ends up being the factor that nationalizes Senate and House races across the country and could build on a Democratic majority in the House and maybe create one in the Senate. However, odds are that Mitch McConnell is still going to be the Senate leader, at least at this point, in 2021, regardless of...
Well, even if he's not the Senate leader, you still have a filibuster. You still
exactly.
have... You know, they'll have a very broad ability to dictate what policies are able to get passed.
Right. And Joe Manchin and Chris Coons in certain circumstances. And maybe if we pick up a seat right. in Arizona, these are going to be the new Ben Nelsons and Joe Liebermans of the Senate who are going to be putting the brakes on everything that progressives want. And so you sat down and tackled one of these issues that we had to deal with through the Obama years, which was this claim that if you expect the president can do stuff without having a supermajority in the Senate, you essentially perceive the president as some type of superhero, specifically Green Lantern. Just tell us briefly about that concept, and then tell us what you guys have basically been working on at the American Prospect, what appears to be for months. And it's yeah. really an incredible piece of journalism.
Right. So, yeah, there's this theory that if you expect presidents by just force of will, like Green Lantern and his ring, to conjure up whatever changes to the government that they want, then you don't understand American government. You don't understand there are checks and balances. There's a judiciary. There's a legislature, and there's public opinion. And you're just your head's in the cloud. This theory that is put forward by usually defenders of a Democratic president is doesn't take into account the fact that for decades and for centuries we've passed laws in this country, and the role of the president is to execute those laws. And in fact, many of those laws are not executed to their fullest or proper potential. And so we sat down at the Prospect and looked at the U.S. Code, and we found 30 different meaningful actions that a president could take based on already passed statutes. So they already have the authority to do it, that they could take actions they could take on day one. And they cover a whole host of areas of public policy. And when you put them all together, they comprise a very robust progressive agenda that can be done with no matter who controls Congress. So we're talking about student debt. You can cancel student debt. You can lower drug prices. You can effectively legalize marijuana. You can give 800,000 workers in the fastest growing profession in the country, which is home health care, you can give them the ability to join a union. You can manage and mitigate climate change. I can't name all of them because we really did scour this. We did 11 different articles. We did a couple more bonus articles online. We rolled it out in our fall issue. And we call it the day one agenda. These are things that there are no constraints, no problems for a president to undertake this stuff.
Yeah, and the value of knowing this at this point, right, in terms of progressives who are looking for these things to be done, is both. In terms of like, I mean, this is why it's great that you did this during the campaign. I hope what you do is in the event that a Democrat wins, you rerun the whole series on whatever it is, November 10th of 2020, God willing. But this is also basically, I mean, if I was moderating the Democratic debates, I would be basically cribbing your entire issue and asking them questions as to whether they would do this.
Yeah, I mean, if I was moderating the debates, I'd be ashamed of myself because the fact that this is kind of information on regulatory actions and things that are under the inherent authority of the president, it has not already been part of these debates and discussions in the primary is like criminal. What do we hire a president to do? We hire a president to execute the laws. We don't hire a president to pass laws. And yet, in these debates, all we talk about is what laws the president will pass. That is inherently The inaccurate, it's the wrong scenario to think about. It's good to know somebody's platform and direction and way they want to take the party. But you can also get at that by asking them what actions they could take that they have the actual power to do on their own. And the fact that that isn't part of what we talk about when we talk about the presidency just suggests that the entire process is broken in some way. It's a media failure, and we're trying to correct it.
All right, we just have about a minute left. You did go out to the candidates, right, and asked them just broadly,
right,
what kind of response did you get, and were you
sure.
surprised by anything?
So
just
we
a minute.
Sent a questionnaire to all 30 all 20 candidates with all 30 of our actions, and you know, Joe Biden didn't send one back, so no data there. But you know, Senator Warren, Senator Sanders broadly agreed to take up most of these things. Beto O'Rourke had a pretty positive response, and some others did as well. The candidates are starting to talk about this kind of stuff, executive authority, even though the media isn't prodding them to do so. And so, you know, we sent this questionnaire out because we wanted some answers, but we also wanted the candidates to know that we actually know what their authority is, and we're going to hold them to it. And so that was one of the primary functions of engaging in this project.
Well, it's an amazing piece of journalism. I appreciate it both, you know, as someone who does this stuff for a living, but also as an activist and someone who's interested in seeing the next president be a progressive and institute some progressive policies.
Let me just say, you can read all of it, every one of those articles, at prospect.org/day-one-agenda.
All right, folks. David Dayan, always a pleasure.
Thank you.
David Dayan is the executive editor of The American Prospect. His first book, Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, was released by the New Press in 2016. When we come back, Heather Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com to support the show. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he's been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.